Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. In the absence of Chair Gomberg, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for April 28, 2015. We are gathered today for the purpose of public hearing on Senate Bill 5539. And the record will indicate that the agenda had an incorrect bill. We have now corrected it for the record. And so, with that, Representative Gomberg is scheduled in three places. He will be with us shortly, and we're going to go ahead and start. Ms. Dyster, you want to tee us up?
As you so aptly described, we are here to hear the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. They've been asked to come on in for a phase two presentation and talk about prioritization of their various program option policy option packages in their budget.
Thank you very much, Mr. Director. Ms. Brickman. I can't help but recognize, as you're getting settled, that very well-mannered dog. What program is he with?
Choice of Living Assistance Dogs.
Well, he's a very well-mannered canine. Mr. Director.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, I am Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but Molly, our service dog, is our best lobbyist in chief for the department. Pleased to be back before you today to discuss our budget. I'll quickly run through some slides that ground us in our work and then get into the prioritization of largely the general funded policy option packages before this committee and the legislature. So right now we are serving four generations of veterans across five major wars and still a nation at war. About 10% of the forces in Afghanistan right now are Oregon National Guard, which speaks both to the dwindling numbers that we see in Afghanistan, but also how heavily we use our Oregon National Guard. And they are beginning to filter back right now, back through Texas and back home to Oregon this spring and this summer. But amazingly, those from World War II to today, and then a broad diversity, men and women, urban and rural, every ethnicity and creed, and then issues that all of our citizens face across education, employment, economic opportunity, health and mental health and housing.
Mr. Director, I'm going to ask you a question that is not germane to this committee, but certainly germane to veterans and how we treat and respect their service. The Senate struggled today with Senate Bill 87 that is a hiring veterans, preference for hiring veterans, where apparently consensus cannot be reached. Have you been involved in any of those negotiations?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we have been part of that task force over the last year, and sometimes very difficult to have a rational policy discussion to move the ball forward. It's going to be a challenging one, I think, for us to navigate going forward, but I don't think anyone is truly being served by the current statutes on the book, and I believe it's a soup sandwich in terms of not clear in terms of veterans' preference for public employers, not clear in terms of how regulators are to approach it, but certainly not clear in terms of what is that preference that our veterans have earned to be applied, not just in terms of points, but as folks do interview processes and we rank and sort. What is the preference and where does it get applied is a critical question for our veterans.
But the big answer is the agency is involved in bringing your expertise, both as a veteran yourself as well as the head of the agency. You're involved in helping to try to find this middle ground. The way it was characterized on the Senate floor today is the bureaucracies are absolutely rigid and around the periphery are the veterans waiting to figure out what are you going to do.
And so, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we're happy to keep working the issue.
Good.
Because it is an important one for our vets.
I think many of us are comforted to hear that. Please continue.
Just as a quick overview, this is our governor's recommended budget going forward for 15-17 biennium. $92 million total funds across the agency for the two-year budget. The bulk of that taken up in two main businesses in terms of the veterans' homes. Skilled nursing facilities, 71% of the budget, other funds driven, at the tune of $65 million. Veterans Home Loan Program that we've had since 1945 after World War II and first stood up as an agency, 16% of our other funded, or 16% of the total funds budget at $15 million of other funds. And then often where our policies are discussed, whether from the policy committees or here in terms of impacts going forward, the general fund portion of 13% of our budget in terms of core veteran services, about $9 million in this biennium and recommended in the governor's budget going forward, $10.7 million. Of that general funded budget, half of it flows down, roughly half of it flows down to the counties and the national service organizations as our partners. For the half that we keep and invest in statewide veteran services, invested in our Portland claims office, Salem claims. Portland largely serves as that way station on claims review as the counties, boots on the ground, submit up claims on disability and low-income pensions. Our Salem office largely is serving Marion and Polk that doesn't have a county veteran service office function. The rest of it, training of the county veteran service officers, educational aid and emergency assistance, and then a small slice of general fund in our conservatorship program, which also captures some other funds through fees on the veterans. All of that general fund that we keep at the statewide level largely is in FTE and staffing costs, not in terms of services and supplies. The only non-FTE portion of that is the educational aid and emergency assistance. Here's the 10-year look back over the last decade in terms of what do we draw
down. Let me stop you there for just a second. Do you have any metrics on the or profile of the kind of cases that have been served in the emergency assistance and the educational benefits? Is there enough of a record to describe?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, we do, in terms of educational aid, is about $88,000 in the proposed recommended budget going forward, serves about 30 veterans a month, and can be up to $150 a monthly benefit for the veteran.
Is that cumulative in a year, or do you get frequent flyers, or can you come back every month? Or
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'm going to have to pull up. I may have to get back to you on that answer in terms of how long it can run for, but it is $150 a month, and I think it runs for 36 months, similar to the GI Bill benefit at the federal level. But of note, in this past biennium, when we had a reduction, that was where we were able to take a reduction without impacting staff that was more highly leveraged across Portland and Salem claims. So that has been on hold, educational aid, since that reduction was taken, I believe, at the end of February.
And how does it work? Is it need-based? Is it first-come, first-served? Because with $88,000, you're going to chew that up pretty fast with a very small number of vets.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, it certainly doesn't stretch very far, and it's positioned to for those that have exhausted their federal GI Bill benefits. Sometimes they didn't qualify for FedVA GI Bill. Sometimes they've exhausted those resources. But it's not a significant, sizable portion making a very meaningful difference in making sure veterans are going back to school.
One last question. Were I a veteran so positioned, are there other options for me? Can I go to the institution and ask for some degree of assistance? I'm trying to figure out $150 a month, how many credit hours that buys, and I'm looking at the education co-chair, and it's not very many. What I'm trying to get to is there a chance to get more bang for the buck for veterans writ large if that benefit were more tightly defined?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, where we've seen some of the best in terms of outcome-driven work in terms of are our student veterans having success on campus by campus, whether community colleges or universities, it largely has been when there is a campus veteran representative on that campus as a center of gravity. You have folks reaching, you know, veterans can reach out to that person as they are looking to enroll to figure out what classes may be qualified by GI Bill. How do you work the GI Bill system? How do you look at other scholarships to make things pencil out, and then ongoing success once they're on campus?
So what I think I heard you say is that it would make more sense to have this gravitational pull of a veteran service officer on a campus to help access a whole basket full of benefits than it is for individual veterans to episodically come in and out of a program that's not very well funded.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, the only I think that's accurate, but the only distinction, we have had a campus veteran service officer program in the past that was funded out of other funds, I believe in the 09-11 budget. what we want to be clear is that we're not duplicating a veteran service office function that we see that we want to strengthen at the county level. So a campus veteran representative has been more the language that we've been using that would be actually a staff member, sometimes under student affairs or the dean of student affairs, that could be that link, whether it's to staff, to professors, to fellow students. And then when they need claims representation, not necessarily having that be the skill set of the campus veteran rep, but be able to link to partners like the county veteran service officers. Since it does, as we'll talk about in one of the POPs in terms of training, it's a significant ramp up to get that federal VA case law, and you can be an excellent referral and belly button and center of gravity on campus, but not necessarily be that service officer representing the power of attorney claim.
Thank you. Senator Monroe.
What percentage of returning veterans make use of their GI Bill to help them pay for their college, their community college, or their universities?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Senator Monroe, I believe 60,000. I know.
60,000 that are currently receiving disability
benefits. So it's, we have, I know about 90,000 are accessing VA healthcare. About 60,000 of our Oregon veterans are asking are accessing their disability benefits and low-income pension. But I have to double-check on the number in terms of the GI Bill specifically.
Well, I just left the board decade on the board at Mount Hood Community College, and the board wanted to figure out a way to make Mount Hood Community College more attractive to veterans. One thing we found was that the GI Bill would only pay their tuition after they completed a term, and many of them didn't have the upfront money to get started. And so the college decided to give the returning veterans the first term tuition paid. Then they would be compensated by the GI Bill, and they could use that money then to pay for the next term, and so on. We also hired a special counselor just for veterans to help them navigate the system. And we found that I think the number of returning veterans that matriculated after that change was like tripled. So I would hope that, I just want to do everything we possibly can for these returning veterans to give them every opportunity to have a good life. And having a good education has got to be part of that.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Senator Monroe, we've often, historically, I feel like we've gotten to a better place, both across community colleges and universities. For a long while, even for this most recent post 9/11 GI Bill, the timings were not always accurate in terms of when you enroll, when the checks would be mailed to the universities. We found that many have stepped up to be more flexible, to be able to make sure that it is a valid option. There are still sometimes gaps that we see, but they're more one-offs and not driven by completely by the institution.
Follow-up, Senator Mumra.
Do you find that these returning veterans who go back to college on the GI Bill are pretty good students, serious students, are successful students? Do you have any a way of measuring that?
So Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, Senator Monroe, we would love to have better data and are somewhat working with the higher education, the HEC, in terms of how do we capture what are the outcomes to know whether these are billions of dollars, largely of federal VA GI Bill resources, but not great numbers in terms of how do we track the outcomes of these student veterans. In terms of how they return to campus, often they are more mature and have lived more life experiences. And sometimes that can be both they know what they want to accomplish and what their major and hit the ground running, but it can also be frustrating. Sometimes having that disconnect, a very different environment than we had in World War II, with 10% of the able-bodied citizens serving and coming back to campuses across the nation, now less than 1% serving in uniform. So often a disconnect that we see across our military and veterans population as they reintegrate home, whether it's back for employment or education.
Senator Monroe.
My father was a college professor starting in 1943 and served and was a college professor for 35 years. He said the best students he ever had were the GIs returning from World War II. They were serious, they really knew what they were all about, knew what they were doing, and that's why Today we still talk about the baby booming generation because they were the progenitors of the baby boom generation when they returned. And my dad was just comparing them to other students that he'd had earlier. He said they were just almost all of them, just very serious, very studious, very well disciplined in their study habits.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Just taking the liberty of reading off Ms. Deister's computer where she quickly called up the information. Between 2009 and 2013, the number of veterans using the GI Bill more than doubled to 12,000 in Oregon and 25,000 in Washington, according to the VA. That means that in 2013 alone, more than 35,000 veterans in Oregon and Washington were using the education benefit to attend college and trade schools.
This is going to be tough. We're going to replace the agency director with the big brain of Google, and we can speed this up.
Mr. Chair,
please.
One other comment following along the line of questioning that Senator Monroe opened, and that is I think collectively the legislature might want to turn its attention to helping facilitate the translation of military education and experience into civilian certificates. My whole background is in aviation, and when one thinks that you cannot directly correlate fighter pilots coming out of the theaters of war to get a civilian certificate, it's mind-boggling. Now, that's the FAA's problem. It isn't ours. But I think we could help maybe lead a trend to make those certificates directly translatable. People that are radio technicians, I don't know all the other things that don't translate, but I have specifically focused on aviation mechanics and aviation pilots. And you have to basically, in the civilian world, go back to zero, even though you've had experience in theaters of war that no civilian pilot would experience. We don't give any credit for that against a civilian certificate.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, both across taking that military experience and transferable skills, translating it into credits at universities and community colleges, and then also on the professional licensing, has been a little, we've got good authorities, but it often comes down to committee by committee or commission by commission in terms of some of the professional licensing that gets challenging. We've got some good overarching in terms of national associations and accreditation across universities and community colleges, but more challenging on the professional side.
Thank you. One last question while Chair Comberg catches his breath, and that is, at Oregon's community colleges right now, how many of them have that gravitational pull of a, whether they're a fully trained CVSO, but they have a veterans campus rep? How many of our community colleges, where I think are veteran-rich environments, how many have such a person?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'd have to circle back and get the answer on. I can think of Chemeketa, PCC on multiple campuses, Clackamas Community College, I believe Blue Mountain as well. Quite a few have stepped up, not through any funding through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs or the feds, but out of their base budgets. You know, sometimes calling it a counselor, sometimes a campus veterans representative. But it's been a huge center of gravity on those campuses.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you for holding down the fort while I was scheduled elsewhere. Mr. Smith, where do we go next?
Simply over the last decade, if you look back a decade, would have had about less than $1 billion of federal VA benefits flowing to Oregon across education benefits, healthcare benefits, compensation, and pension, low-income pension payments. Now over $2.2 billion. Half of that is cold, hard cash in terms of disability compensation and pension benefits. A robust almost billion-dollar VA healthcare system, both across medical centers and clinics. And then $128 million on GI Bill benefits being spent in Oregon. And these are 2013 dollars. FedVA should update here shortly to get us the 2014 numbers. In terms of our policy option packages, both across general funded strategies and other funded strategies, they've been rooted in our strategic framework, and we won't dive into all the strategies underneath these. But in terms of that biggest opportunity that we have is to leverage the $160 billion behemoth of the annual budget of the federal VA. How do we work with our county and state veteran service officers to draw down more of those resources? When they aren't eligible for federal VA, how do we mobilize those broader partnerships and leverage all resources for veterans? Sometimes it's also not just a lack of resources, but a lack of awareness of the resources that are out there. So that third pillar pillar of our strategic framework of driving veteran engagement, and lastly, invigorating our core operations of those core programs that we are directly responsible for with the home loan program and skilled nursing. The only thing I would add on this framework is we also went through a performance audit by the Secretary of State this past fall, and many of the recommendations that they came out with matched the core strategies underneath here that are embedded in our policy option packages going forward. Out of these are the four general funded policy option packages that we'll go quickly through. Package 101 is the training and certification. It's our top priority for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We went to the e-board, I'm forgetting the time, but approximately halfway through this current biennium, went to the e-board. Given how much we had seen turnover in the county veteran service officers and the need to make sure that they get trained up. About an 18-month process to make them well aware of all the federal VA law and case law to help make sure that they are submitting the best claims for our veterans. I had not mentioned all of those strategies are to identify more veterans, submit more and better claims, draw down those federal funds, and coordinate leverage partners and invest in upfront preventative strategies. There's 58 county veteran service officers across the state in addition to the ones at the statewide level. 40 of those are now accredited and 18 are unaccredited. Many of those are close to accreditation, but what we are finding is the ongoing need of having that second training officer, both for the ongoing changes that we see across federal VA law, but also to make sure that we are supporting those county veteran service officers as much as we can. Average life cycles, not life cycle, but how long they stay in the job, about 4 to 5 years. We're finding the turnover rate is significant given the burden that sometimes a lone rural county veteran service officer has on their shoulders, both serving those veterans and being that belly button in the community. So that training officer position.
Excuse me, Mr. Smith, being that what in the community?
Center of gravity, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, being the belly button in that community for all things veterans,
all right.
Whether it's employment-related, healthcare-related, beyond
that, that's
the
a technical term, isn't it?
Correct.
Yes. Okay, very good.
As long as we've taken this levity break, could you, Mr. Director, get for the professional staff a list of those CVSOs throughout Oregon and their telephone numbers? You just said that part of the burnout factor is the feeling of isolation, and I think that maybe legislators who are very quick to acknowledge all things veteran could do a better job of reaching out to our own CVSOs and offering them support and appreciation for the work they do. I know it's very difficult work, and the sense for many of them who are retired military of not leaving a man behind or woman behind is an enormous personal moral burden for them. This is pretty hard work in some cases, and frankly, having to fight for the benefits that veterans were promised and earned, I think, is disgraceful. And these guys are on the front line of trying to make that happen, and I know many of them approach their job in a very personal mindset.
Co-Chair Johnson, we certainly can, and thank you for that message of support. We've also seen not just turnover from whether retirement age or what's going on in their life, but simply more hiring. So counties are stepping up, whether Umatilla going from one part-time to two full-time, Multnomah County. So both across urban and rural Oregon, seeing more county veteran service officers come online at that county level, which is a great success. One of the successes we've seen in Lincoln County, where you have one county veteran service officer looking to retire, they bring on that second younger one coming up in the pipeline, but have that left seat and right seat transition, so it's not a on day one, they have to know everything and take on that full range of the office, but can have that transition period and begin to get schooled up both at the local level and from our training officer. Also, so that is about 200,000 of the package on that training officer. Approximately 150, I believe, for the actual salary and benefits for the 2 years, but also a more robust SNS than we would see for a typical position, given the statewide impact.
One other thing, Mr. Director. I was out visiting with one of my county veteran service officers and discovered that there is a considerable lag in pay. And I don't know whether that's unique, and I should work this as a case management offline with you, but he had been working out of his own pocket for quite a long period of time, like as much as a quarter. And I think waiting 3 months to get paid for the hard work that's being done is not very good. And if I'm looking at the faces of your staff behind you who are showing some degree of surprise, so I'm going to assume this is anomalous, and I'll take this away from the committee and work it directly with your professional staff.
And co-chairs, members of the committee, it may be a, if someone is a part-time position but then going above and beyond what they have been allocated, it may be a one-off scenario. We can certainly dig in. Also embedded in Package 101, out of our strategic framework, looking to repurpose some of the veteran service officers that we have both in Portland and Salem. Reclassing five positions in that second bullet point, about $25,000 in that policy option package, the slice of this one. One would be on claims review. Instead of simply having the veteran, historically the veteran service officers in our Portland office, we're also working on direct claims, but we're trying to position it as more value added to the counties, where they are truly doing claims review, not just making sure the paperwork is correct, but the analysis on that claim going forward is correct, to make sure that we're not going into appeals with the federal VA and that we get the rated decisions correctly the first time. Out of our Salem office, two positions. We've had some underserved populations, whether homeless veterans, incarcerated veterans, trying to position the veteran service officer not just for our Salem statewide ones, not simply doing those direct benefit claims for local veterans, but being that hub of the wheel to better serve incarcerated veterans or homeless veterans across the state, to be able to share best practices, whether it's on a stand down or whether it's on reentry of incarcerated veterans. The final two reclasses are an office specialist to an admin specialist and a public service rep one to a public service rep three, in terms of the kind of work that we are asking them to do those as well. The last piece of that,
Mr. Director, is it an appropriate key performance measure for those folks to track the number of claims that result in an award without appeal? Or are the populations that they're serving so different? I would assume that incarcerated or homeless are perhaps a more difficult population to work with because they have accessibility to records and all of that sort of stuff. I don't want to be unfair to folks that are working with a more difficult clientele, but is that something we ought to be tracking?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, we do track in terms of the number of power of attorneys that we take on every year, and we do track in terms of the total dollars flowing back on disability and low-income pensions. We haven't gotten to the granularity across specific populations, and would be more challenging for your homeless. It would be the most challenging on the homeless. We begin to better break it out across women veterans or incarcerated veterans. But we currently don't have strings on our funding that hinge off of that. So there's not a punishment if you're working with a more difficult population and more risk.
For sure.
Okay, thank you.
And the last piece of, in terms of aligning funding with the actual positions, out of the last biennium's budget, we had a fund shift to make sure that the core veteran services FTE were funded off of the general fund. We have since moved the conservatorship program and the loan program from under Veteran Services Division to bring the rigor of that focus and attention to that main core part of the work, and have home loan programs separate and distinct. And this last $90,000 in this pot would align that funding to make sure all of the Veteran Services Division is on the general fund. In terms of our second priority, we talked about the value added of that training down to the counties, but out of this committee's work, out of Senator Johnson and also Representative Jensen, had a $1 million outreach grant that was one-time funded out of this last biennium, and Package 102 is a request to continue that funding. This is an area that we've seen great success. It was $10,000 base to every county that has a county veteran service office. $60,000 reserved for the increased workload that we saw at our Portland claims for ODVA, and then $600,000 in competitive grants down to the counties. About 26 requests came in, 19 were fully funded, all received some partial funding, ranged from $9,000 up to $74,000 in grant awards. Much of what we saw the counties invest in were across that staffing, whether making a part-time VSO full-time, bringing on an assistant, almost like a paralegal for the veteran service officer, technology upgrades, and also outreach. When we've run the numbers of counties that had the grant compared to counties that did not have the increased funding through the outreach grant, an 18% increase in counties that had the grant, whereas we saw an 11% increase in power of attorney claims from counties that didn't. So about a 7% gap. And when we run it through, roughly all claims have a 60% are rated successfully by the federal VA on average 60% of the time. Our per capita average is almost $17,000. So what we are hinging off of that $1 million outreach grant is a return of $5.5 million in additional compensation, disability compensation, and low-income pension that we wouldn't have seen if not for the grant. This is the boots on the ground, county by county. ODVA in a rural county is a much higher percent of their budget, but significantly these counties are stepping up to fund these positions, and this is a value-added grant on top of that. The other piece, $300,000 that you see as a reduction in other fund, would be the outreach that we are conducting currently off of loan program resources, but for that core function of veteran services. This is both the online, the print, somewhat of that centralized marketing, that so we don't have 34 county veteran service officers all going in a different direction from our benefit magazine, from the online portals that we've created for the counties, to be able to capture those indirect, but what are largely direct work in terms of driving veteran engagement across the state. Any questions on 102? Okay. Pressing forward, package 103. This is an IT modernization, both on IT hardware and then project analysis going forward. Just under $400,000 of general fund requested. When we look across the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I think across much of state government, but we are on I-series green screen mainframes that are difficult for us, both for our business functions of home loans, veterans homes, and our other core functions, but also simply from the databases. We've seen great work across DMV, DHS, and a bill pending before the legislature on Oregon Health Authority, capturing information when citizens are engaging with state agencies and having that information shipped over to ODVA, that we can have something of a database to have a customer relationship management, so that we're not simply, when a veteran calls in, that we are tracking these information and we can track what the results are. We have had that on our claims management system in terms of Vetrospect, now a cloud-based system that we can track all claims. It's not a programmer on state time. It's off the shelf. We can get it customized. The resources are out there in terms of a home loan product, in terms of a conservatorship, and this policy option package would, other than the hardware, would be to analyze how are we going to bring on that veterans contact database going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Co-Chair Johnson.
Forgive me, Mr. Director, if I have asked this already or should have asked this. Are you sucked into Scenic? The enterprise, we keep changing the names to protect the guilty. Ms. Brickman can help me remember what we call it now.
Was the State Data Center is now Enterprise Technology Services.
So co-chairs, members of the committee, in terms of this specific policy option package, working with the CIO's office and the Enterprise Technology Services, ETS, and it's one of the reasons, not just from how do we better serve veterans, but for those that are remaining on the I-Series technology, it does reside at the ETS, the data center, State Data Center. And as we shift, Department of Revenue is undergoing its own change off of I-Series. As Department of Corrections makes its shift, our costs will go up at the ETS for what we have there currently.
That's my point. Mr. Chair, follow up.
Please.
That's my point. Two things about it. First of all, the costs are so unpredictable coming out of the Department of Administrative Services. Some small agencies have had their costs increase 84%, 65%. And so getting a handle on what your costs are going to be going forward using that enterprise technology services is going to be really important. And secondly, agencies are currently assessed given the amount of computing time that they're using, and you are designing a system that goes out and increases your usage because you want to track veterans in some cohesive way. So with every contact, you're driving your costs. And I think trying to get pinned down what the expectations for your total usage assessment is going to be is really important, because some of these small boards and commissions are getting nasty surprises in terms of quote-unquote truing up their usage commensurate with what they're getting assessed. And I support the notion of having a database, as long as it can be managed in a way that protects veterans' privacy, that tracks the benefits, the accessibility to the agency, all the rest of that stuff. But you better know what your costs are so you don't get an ugly surprise at the end of some biennium.
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, separate even from those challenges through centralized services and IT services at our own department level, simply the expertise in the COBOL iSeries computer language, they are not training this for folks coming out of workforce development today. So many of our folks who have built these systems, they are working, they are functioning. We are able to generate reports and do the taxes and do the impacts across home loans, our skilled nursing, and our other programs. But we are not able, as we make that shift, we will lose the expertise in terms of staff simply retiring and not being able to hire that expertise back. Our last general funded policy option package, Package 104, a little over $400,000, build as strategic partnerships. What we know, when we know our veterans have impacts across all these different policy areas, we're not going to be able to recreate the wheel on a housing homelessness program, but at the department, or a suicide prevention program, but at the department. But how do we link to other efforts, bring our military veterans lens to those larger efforts, whether across state agencies or public-private partnerships? And this would position us to have two policy analysts across two big buckets of health and wellness and education and economic opportunity. It is both to link us to other systems and to pull their systems in and link them to us. And one example that came out both out of our strategic framework and out of the Secretary of State audit, the Paris program with Department of Human Services, the Public Assistance Reporting Information System, being able to better identify those that are on state general fund support systems that could be potentially targeted for federal VA benefits. These are two policy analysts that would begin to break down the silos to make sure that we are tapping it, not just from that IT perspective or the outreach perspective or making sure they are trained, but making sure that we are linking the systems across the silos of state government.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
One that I want to go back and explore, and you just talked about suicide prevention. I've gotten confused over time about how many different contracts and point of entry we have for veterans that may be contemplating taking their own lives. And I happen to know the Lines for Life program very well and very favorably, but I'm trying to figure out, how many portals are there? What's the level of training? What's the level of accessibility? How do we pick that portal with the best record of success? Where should it appropriately be housed? Is it a contract between you and a vendor? I've heard that there's one school of thought that would run it through addictions and mental health OHA. Help enlighten me. How many systems are there right now, and how efficacious are they?
So, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, to the best of my knowledge, two primary contracts in terms of suicide prevention crisis lines. One, the primary one for all Oregonians, leveraged through the Addictions and Mental Health and the Oregon Health Authority, I believe approximately $750,000 or somewhere in that ballpark, under $1 million. For that statewide line, which is currently awarded to Lines for Life out of Portland. Out of the last budget, we had $350,000 specifically for a veterans crisis line component through an RFP process, also landed on Lines for Life being that contract awarded. So those are the two main. At the national level, through both the Department of Defense and the federal VA, there's an overarching crisis and suicide prevention line. Lines for Life happens to be, it's a major call center back in New York for the whole 24/7, but when they are overwhelmed for our regional calls, those calls bump to Lines for Life, even from that national line. I think one of the risks in putting suicide prevention crisis line resources into two different agency budgets is potentially through a fair and open RFP process, you could land on two different contracts. It is difficult just to get the market penetration to make sure that our military and our veterans and their families know what is the number to call when they are in crisis. To be able to have that all together in one contract would be significant. if there is resources to keep military and veterans line coming through our budget, there may be opportunity to have a budget note that it still gets identified through ODVA's budget, but that gets mashed together for the overarching state line as well.
Well, one important thing that I have been told is that through Lines for Life, veterans are answering the phone. I mean, I liken that to me going into a gym and having some size 3 say, I feel your pain. No, you don't. I would want to know that there was a peer, someone who had some sense of my life experience as a veteran, answering the phone. Does that not have sufficient value in and of itself to say that there should be a separate line for veterans, that they're not getting tossed in with teenagers or other populations?
Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I think both the professional certification that you would expect of any crisis resource line to have is ground zero, but that peer-to-peer expertise is helpful to know, to be able to relate to the person on the other line, whether it is a teenager or whether it's a veteran. There have been those volunteer, the veteran peer-to-peer and military family component of that Lines for Life crisis line, and that's helpful. So when we look at the ROI, not just on those policy option packages, but on the entire general fund portion of 10.7 through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, we expect to increase power of attorney and claims by 5.6% every fiscal year. When we do the math through 2017, we believe we can draw down an additional $90.8 million of disability compensation and pension every year for Oregon veterans. When we look at simply when we access another 100 additional veterans and sign them up for power of attorney and represent them up to the federal VA, for every 100, 60 will be successful in that claim, and it draws down just over $1 million every year. This goes, and when we've shown previously in our slides, both the impact across urban and rural Oregon in terms of those cash payments that then also make you eligible for VA health care and other benefits. What is harder to capture is what does that reduce in terms of TANF, in terms of the other safety net services across DHS or OHA or other state agencies, but significant savings as we get more folks onto federal VA that we would also see onto the general fund. In terms of the other funded policy option packages, we are seeing increased demand across the Veterans Home Loan Program, both in terms of processing those home loans, but also in terms of new regulations and compliance that we're seeing out of national legislation. We would bring on one new FTE. We had a reduction in home loan staff, I believe, back in 2003 and again in 2012, roughly. So this is from the depths of the housing recession in terms of 2008, 2009, when loans took a dive in terms of how many we were originating. Now we are back in the past year over just under 60 million in originations and needing some additional support on the veterans home side. They also have a portion of that IT modernization. We're looking at using other funds and moving forward with conservatorship first in terms of a smaller program, but very quickly trying to get the home loan program off of that green screen iSeries technology, and it would match that general funded one on the policy option package 103. And this would be both on the origination front and then also on the servicing. ODVA does not sell off the loans, so we service them through the life of the loan. So it's also that ongoing service from an IT perspective. Any questions on the home loan?
What's your default rate right now? It's historically been very low.
In terms of foreclosures, Co-Chair? Mm-hmm. Less than 1.5, always well below comparison to the private market, and speaks to the flexibility that the legislature has embedded in the statutes to make sure that ODVA is doing everything in its power, whether it's a gap in employment, a healthcare challenge. We are very flexible in terms of working with the veterans to keep them and their family in the home. So across our veterans home, now referring to our veterans home as the Aging Veteran Services Program, just like the The policy option package 104, in terms of the policy analysts across health and wellness and education and economic opportunity, I would position the aging veteran services director and just simply the name change. We can run our core program of two skilled nursing facilities well, 300 beds once we fully bring the Lebanon facility online with the DALs. But 320,000 veterans across the state, roughly half, over half of them age 60 to 100 years old. It won't simply be through our skilled nursing facilities that we take care of the needs of aging veterans across the state, whether for their economic security, their housing, or other services. We have brought over Mary Yeager from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office to head up now, to bring that skilled nursing perspective to our two core programs, but also to bring that broader perspective. This is a temporary position that we brought on beginning in March, so looking to continue it out of other funds through the the Veterans Home Program, but already seeing that partnership breaking down silos across agency. It sounds good and is hard to quantify, but we are seeing the results already, having brought Mary Yeager on board, and we expect the same out of those other policy analysts. The other piece of this package in terms of aging veteran services, this is a contract program with a professional management team, but we do have four total staff from ODVA, two at each facility, and this would begin to ramp up on their role for those liaison services as the eyes and ears for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs for these contracted facilities. Any questions on aging veteran services?
No questions.
Any questions overall that we can help answer?
I think we're good, Mr. Smith.
So excellent. We appreciate the opportunity to come back before you and certainly willing to work with you going forward. No short order in terms of the resources allocated and the broad range of priorities that you all will see as we move towards the May revenue forecast. Looking forward to working with you as you do the prioritization.
All right. Well, if we're concluded, I will conclude then the public hearing on Senate Bill 5505. And Ms. Dyster, where do we go next?
Well, that concludes today's agenda. Tomorrow, I believe you had something added to your agenda for a special informational hearing.
That's correct.
Yes. So, but that's all for today.
Special informational hearing on
the truck program at
the relationship between Daimler and OSU in doing research on carbon reductions and diesel fuel efficiency.
And that's for tomorrow, so.
That'll be tomorrow. Anything for the good of the order? Then we are adjourned. Thank you all so much. We are adjourned. Thank you all so much.